and into the early 1960s as he became a reporter. On a trip to London in 1964, Haley stopped in at the British Museum and saw the Rosetta Stone. He thought back to the impenetrable words of the African. The next year, he was in Washington, D.C., and visited the National Archives. There, he found the names of his emancipated slave ancestors in North Carolina, just as his relatives had recounted. Haley decided to use genealogy to find the African and then write a book about the experience. "In America, I think, there has not been such a book," Haley told his editor, "Rooting a Negro Family All the Way Back." Haley's research led him to conclude that the African in his past had been brought from the Gambia. He flew there and made inquiries, which ultimately led him to a traditional historian known as a griot. The griot looked Haley over and said he resembled a people called the Kinte. To Haley, the name sounded suspiciously like Kinte. The griot told him about one man from that group, named Kunta Kinte. His biography seemed to fit what Haley knew of the African. Haley declared that he had discovered his kin. The news that an American cousin had returned raced through the Kinte villages. When Haley drove to see them, children shouted to him in greeting, "Mr. Kinte!" In 1976, Haley published an account of his ancestry called Roots, The Saga of an American Family. It opened with Kunta Kinte's life in Africa and then followed him to the American colonies, where he became a slave and started the family line that would lead to Alex Haley himself. Roots was something that African Americans had never encountered before. Haley was excavating hidden cables that connected living African Americans to their slave ancestors and all the way back to particular people on the mother continent. And it was irresistible, not just to black audiences, but to white ones as well. Roots sold 1.5 million copies in hardback in its first 18 months and was turned into a television miniseries that drew an estimated 130 million viewers. The emotional power of Roots was impossible to deny. But when the historian Willie Lee Rose read the book, something didn't seem quite right. Or rather, many little things seemed wrong. Haley wrote that Kunta Kinte picked cotton in northern Virginia in the 1760s. Cotton was never grown so far north. Kunta Kinte supposedly put up wire fencing on his plantation. Wire fencing only came into general use a century later. "These anachronisms are petty only in that they are details," Rose wrote in the New York Review of Books in 1976. She worried that they were symptoms of a more profound flaw running through the entire book. "They are too numerous and chip away at the verisimilitude of central matters in which it is important to have full faith," Rose warned. At first, Haley shirked off such criticisms, but the questions didn't stop. He tried to defend Roots by describing the many years of research he had put into it. And sometimes he dodged the questions by calling Roots faction. But his opponents only grew more persistent. Two novelists took Haley to court, accusing him of lifting long passages of their work. Haley settled one case, paying out $650,000. Even worse than the plagiarism, however, was the emerging realization that the genealogical bonds at the heart of the book didn't hold up to scrutiny. An expert on African oral history tracked down the griot Haley had met and concluded that he had no way of knowing the details of an 18th century Kinte boy's life. The griot had simply told Haley what he wanted to hear. Professional genealogists presented a catalog of errors, cherry-picking, and wishful thinking. They concluded there was no evidence that Kunta Kinte was Toby, or that Toby was Alex Haley's ancestor. Yet the power in the story brought out many defenders. The fact-checkers, they argued, were ignoring what the book meant to readers, how it changed their relationship to the past. Suddenly, white Americans were tuning in to the horrors of a period too many schoolbooks had tried to sugarcoat, said Clarence Page, an African-American journalist. Suddenly, black Americans were asking their elders relentless questions about a past too many elders had been reluctant to talk about, and that too many of us, their children, were reluctant to hear. To the film critic Eugenia Collier, these outcomes didn't matter. She still felt betrayed. "I believe that Haley sold out," she said in 1979. She accused Haley of getting rich off of a painful absence at the heart of African-American life. "I think," Collier said, "that I would give almost anything I own to know who my African ancestors were." Roots drove another boom in genealogy, not just among African Americans, but in its white audience, too. At first, these new genealogists could only riffle through the same old library folders, the same parish records, and the same census forms as the genealogists who came before them. But by the end of the 20th century, the Internet had become a powerful new tool for their searches. Governments and churches put their records online. Genealogists shared their research with each other on online forums and through new companies. By one estimate, genealogy has now become the second most popular search topic on the Internet. It is outranked only by porn. Before the online age, my own family tree looked like a split elm, half killed by a blight. While my mother could trace Goodspeed's and other ancestors back to the Puritan colonies and to England, we knew little about my father's line. But the Internet held a wealth of details about his side of the family. My relatives have documented how my great-grandfather Jacob Zimmer traveled from the Ukraine to Newark in 1892. We learned that some of Jacob's brothers also came to America, while other Zimmers stayed behind. My brother Ben, who has inherited the genealogy allele from my mother, discovered some pictures of their village on the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum's website. The photos are of heaps of bodies, either freshly shot or excavated just after the war. The Zimmers did not have to be herded into concentration camps to be murdered. The Nazis brought the slaughter to them. As powerful as genealogy has become, it still gives us only abstract assurances of a biological connection. My birth certificate makes me pretty certain my parents did indeed pass down their genes to me. But babies can be switched, stolen, removed. Fathers can deny paternity. Paperwork can be lost or botched. Online, faulty information can propagate across the planet, their falsehoods infecting one database after another. The only inescapable proof for our biological ancestry is what we inherit in our cells. Judges had to grapple with genealogy's uncertainties for centuries before biologists could offer any help. When faced with paternity disputes, Roman courts relied on the principle of pater est quem nuptiae demonstrant. The father is the one whom marriage points out. A married woman's children should always be treated as her husband's children, even if she gave birth a year after his death. In later centuries, judges sometimes followed the principle far beyond what nature could allow. In 1304, a husband who had been away from England for 3 years came home to find a new child in his house. He went to court to deny being the father, but the judge rejected his case, declaring, "The privity between a man and his wife cannot be known." Over time, judges developed another guiding principle that came to be called bald eagle evidence. If something looks like a bald eagle, in other words, it probably had bald eagles for parents. I have always considered likeness as an argument of a child being the son of a parent, a British judge said in 1769, for in everything there is a resemblance, as of features, size, attitude, and action. Judges were still deciding if children looked like their fathers well into the 20th century, but the rise of genetics and molecular biology prompted some scientists to wonder if it might be possible to categorically establish kinship, to see the very atoms of heredity that tie families together. One of the first attempts to bring this science to court was made by the actor Charlie Chaplin. In 1942, Chaplin began an affair with an aspiring young actress from Brooklyn named Joan Barry. Chaplin treated her like a toy to be discarded, but when he eventually abandoned Barry, she did not go away quietly. Instead, she smashed the windows of his mansion and broke in one night, armed with a gun, demanding he take her back. By then, Chaplin had already moved on to another affair, this time with a teenager named Una O'Neill. Barry responded by telling a Hollywood gossip columnist that Chaplin had seduced her and left her pregnant. In June 1943, well into Barry's pregnancy, her mother filed a civil paternity suit against Chaplin on behalf of her unborn grandchild. She demanded $2,500 a month, plus $10,000 in prenatal costs. Soon, Chaplin was facing not just a civil suit, but a criminal one as well. J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, had always found Chaplin a suspicious character. His anti-Nazism seemed to Hoover no different than communism. Now he relished the opportunity to find some dirt on the actor. In February 1944, Chaplin was charged with violating the Mann Act by transporting Barry across state lines for immoral purposes while she was still a minor. He was also charged with conspiring with Los Angeles police to put Barry in jail for vagrancy. Gawkers and reporters packed a Los Angeles courthouse for the criminal trial, which dredged up lurid details about Chaplin and Barry's affair. While Chaplin admitted to sleeping with Barry, other men testified that they had been with her during the same period. The jury acquitted Chaplin of all the charges, prompting cheers from around the courthouse. Next came the civil suit over Chaplin's paternity. Between the two trials, Barry had given birth to a girl she named Carol Ann. Chaplin's lawyers came into court ready to raise the prospect that Carol Ann was the daughter of one of Barry's lovers who had testified in the criminal case. And then they would present evidence that Carol Ann could not be Chaplin's daughter because she had not inherited his genes. Chaplin's lawyers could not actually read Carol Ann's genes. In the 1940s, scientists still weren't sure what genes were even made of. The best they could manage was to trace the effects of those genes through pedigrees. Sometimes those effects took the form of hereditary diseases, such as PKU. But there was one inherited trait that could be traced through just about everyone, their blood type. Blood types were first discovered in 1900, and 8 years later, a Polish serologist named Ludwig Hertzfeld demonstrated that they followed Mendel's law. A gene called ABO encodes a protein that sits on the surface of red blood cells. The most common variants are A, B, and O. Both A and B are dominant over O. In other words, if you inherit an A variant from your mother and an O from your father, you're A. Only if you inherit two O's do you have O blood type. Inheriting A and B leads to blood type AB. Hertzfeld realized that these hereditary rules made it impossible for families to have certain combinations of blood types. If a child is blood type A, then one of its parents must carry the A variant. It's simply impossible for a type O mother and a type B father to have a type A son, for example. Writing in The Lancet in 1919, Hertzfeld and his wife, Hanke, predicted that under certain circumstances, this discovery would make it possible to find the real father of a child. In 1926, a court in Germany used blood types to resolve a paternity dispute for the first time. Gradually, the practice gained more attention, although many remained skeptical of its accuracy. In the months leading up to Chaplin's civil trial, his lawyers negotiated a deal with Barry's team. In exchange for $25,000, Barry would agree to have herself and her baby tested for their blood types. If the rules of heredity eliminated Chaplin, she would drop her suit. The tests turned out exactly as Chaplin had hoped. Barry had type A, and Carol Ann had type B. Those findings pointed to an inescapable conclusion. Carol Ann's father, whoever he might be, had to have type B blood. Chaplin was type O. Carol Ann had thus inherited nothing from Chaplin. Yet Barry refused to drop the case. She had gotten a new lawyer who would not abide by the deal made by her previous ones. Chaplin's lawyers brought the blood test results to the judge to get the case thrown out of court. But blood type tests were still such a novelty in California that the state offered no legal guidance about their reliability. The judge allowed the case to proceed, and in January 1945, Chaplin was back in court. Throughout the trial, 15-month-old Carol Ann sat on her mother's lap. Barry turned her daughter's face toward the jury to allow them to gather bald eagle evidence, judging whether she looked like Chaplin or not. Showing none of the temperament of her mother, plaintiff Joan Barry, who sobbed on her attorney's shoulder, or defendant Chaplin, who shouted his denials, she quietly amused herself by napping, yawning, and gurgling, a reporter for Life wrote. Chaplin's lawyers countered the bald eagle with blood. They called a doctor to the stand to explain the blood type results, with charts, diagrams, and elaborate explanations, as the Associated Press reported. They introduced a report into evidence that included tests from two other doctors, one appointed by Barry's lawyers and a neutral one, in accordance with the well-accepted laws of heredity, the doctors declared. The man, Charles Chaplin, cannot be the father of the child. Once the lawyers had introduced all their evidence, the blood test, the stories of sex with other men around the time that Carol Ann was conceived, the bald eagle evidence of her infant face, they left the jury to decide the matter. Barry's lawyer urged them to recognize Carol Ann's place on the Chaplin family tree. You'll sleep well the night you give this baby a name, he promised them. To the jury, Mendel's law could apparently be stretched like taffy. They told the judge they were deadlocked with 7 jurors convinced the chaplain was not the father and 5 that he was. Barry's lawyers filed a second suit. This time they won, the jury deciding Chaplin was indeed Carol Ann's father. The decision set off an uproar. Unless the verdict is upset, the Boston Herald declared, California has in effect decided that black is white, 2 and 2 are 5, and up is down. Nevertheless, Chaplin was ordered to pay $75 a week to support Carol Ann. All told, he would go on to pay her $82,000. The toll that the case took on his reputation was even greater. No one in Hollywood wanted to work with a little tramp anymore. Chaplin left Hollywood for good. The court's decision ultimately didn't help Joan Barry much either. Her mental health spiraled downward until 1953, when she was found wandering the streets, holding a child's ring and a pair of baby sandals, repeatedly saying, "This is magic." Barry was taken to a mental hospital for treatment. After her release, she disappeared. Carol Ann was left to Barry's relatives to raise, a child of a vanished mother and a never-known father. The California legislature was so embarrassed by Chaplin's case that it quickly told state courts to treat blood type tests as conclusive. The tests would go on to resolve many other paternity disputes, although they also had one profound limitation. They could only rule certain men out. They could not definitively rule men in. Carol Ann's test showed that Chaplin could not be her father because her father must have had type B blood. Millions of men were left as possible parents. The problem with a blood type test was that it was based on a comparison of a few different versions of a single protein. It could not reveal things that could definitively prove a hereditary bond between one child and one parent. Those things do exist, though. They are the basis of DNA in our genomes. But it would not be until the late 20th century that scientists invented technologies enabling them to read bits of our genetic material. Even in short fragments, there was enough information to reunite some families, even after they had been dead for decades. In 1917, Tsar Nicholas II and his wife, Tsarina Alexandra, along with their 5 children, were captured by the Ural Soviets. The Soviet revolutionaries held them in a house in Yekaterinburg for months, only to execute them along with their servants. In the years after the revolution, investigations into the killings failed to find the bodies. Rumors circulated that one or more of the children escaped the slaughter and slipped out of the Soviet Union. Over the years, more than 200 people came forward claiming to be a prince or a princess. In the 1970s, a Yekaterinburg geologist named Alexander Avdonin developed an obsession with the mystery. He snooped through archives for clues to what had happened. After years of research, Avdonin and some friends discovered a shallow pit not far from the house where the family had been held. The pit yielded bones from 9 different people. Some of the skulls bore bullet holes. Some of the bones had been pierced with bayonets. Avdonin kept the grave a secret until the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. When he revealed his discovery, the Russian government launched a forensic investigation of the skeletons. Researchers discovered gold and silver in the teeth, a sign the remains belonged to aristocrats. As part of the investigation, the Russian government enlisted a British forensic scientist named Peter Gill. Gill was able to extract fragments of DNA from the bones. The fragments contained repeating sequences called short tandem repeats. This sort of genetic material can tell scientists a lot about heredity because it is especially prone to mutations. In some cases, cells accidentally duplicate some of the repeats. In other cases, they cut some out. These mutations aren't harmful because the segments are not involved in making proteins. Over the generations, families will gain distinctive sets of short tandem repeats. 2 people who share a matching set are probably close relatives. Examining the Yekaterinburg bones, Gill found that segments in the children matched either one of the adults or the other. In other words, this was a family. But which family? No one had preserved any tissues from the Romanovs from which scientists could isolate DNA in order to make a precise match. Living relatives would have to stand in for them. To make the match, Gill took advantage of a special set of genes that lie beyond our chromosomes. They lurk inside mitochondria, the pouches where our cells generate fuel. Each mitochondrion carries 37 genes of its own, which encode proteins essential for its tasks. Mitochondria also divide on their own, making new copies of their own DNA without any meiosis. What makes mitochondrial DNA especially attractive to geneticists is the way in which it is passed down from generation to generation. Both eggs and sperm contain mitochondria, but if a sperm manages to make contact with an egg, it produces enzymes that shred its own mitochondrial DNA. The mother's mitochondria, and only the mother's mitochondria, becomes the mitochondria of her child. This quirk means that mitochondrial DNA can act as a record of our maternal ancestry. Meiosis scrambles chromosomes from one generation to the next, but we inherit a precise replica of our mother's mitochondrial DNA. What's more, your mother got her mitochondrial DNA from your grandmother, who got it from your great-grandmother, and so on back through more generations than even the most stubborn child can ask about. Each time mitochondria duplicate their DNA, there is a minuscule chance that it will mutate. That new mutation will be inherited down the maternal line in future generations. If a woman's female descendant picks up a second mutation, the mitochondrial DNA will now get passed down with both distinctive mutations. Relatives can be joined by this mitochondrial record of their shared ancestry. Like the Habsburgs before them, the Russian Tsars were tightly bound by marriage to the other royal families of Europe. Tsarina Alexandra, for example, was the daughter of Princess Alice of England, who in turn was the daughter of Queen Victoria. Tsarina Alexandra thus inherited Queen Victoria's mitochondrial DNA, and Alexandra passed it on in turn to the Romanov princes and princesses. Looking over royal pedigrees, Gill realized that there was someone alive who also inherited Victoria's mitochondrial DNA, Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh and the husband of Queen Elizabeth II. Prince Philip is the great-great-grandson of Queen Victoria through a line of female ancestors. Gill contacted Philip, who agreed to provide his DNA for the research. Gill found that Philip's mitochondrial DNA matched the genetic material in the remains of one of the Yekaterinburg adults, along with all the children. This result indicated that the adult was Alexandra. The remains of the other adult in the pit had a different sequence of mitochondrial DNA. Gill found that it matched genetic material from a relative of Tsar Nicholas. When Gill and his colleagues published their results in 1994, it seemed to many observers that they had tied the Romanov mystery up in an especially neat bow. In 1998, the skeletons were interred in the Cathedral of Saints Peter and Paul in St. Petersburg. Yet, even after the burial, some skeptics questioned the identity of the bones. They raised the possibility that someone else's DNA had contaminated the equipment used to study the bones. If Avdonin really had found three of the five Romanov children, then what had become of the other two? The skeptics speculated that the bones in the shallow pit belonged to relatives. Given how many Russian aristocrats were slaughtered at the time, it seemed like a plausible alternative explanation. Archaeologists continued to study the area where Avdonin had found the shallow pit, and in 2007, more bones turned up, 230 feet from the original grave. Russian and American anthropologists inspected 44 bone fragments and teeth from the second site and concluded that they came from at least two individuals. The shape of the remains indicated that some belonged to a girl in her late teens, while the others probably belonged to a boy between 12 and 15 years old. The silver fillings in their teeth indicated they were aristocrats. Once again, Gill examined the remains, this time working with researchers from the U.S. Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory. They also extracted more DNA from the bones originally found by Avdonin. Once again, DNA from the original five skeletons showed they were parents and children, and the two new skeletons belonged to the family as well. At last, all seven of the Romanovs were reunited through a genetic genealogy. As scientists learned how to analyze larger pieces of DNA, they could uncover more variants joining people together in lineages. They could go beyond close cousins and join people sharing common ancestors who lived thousands of years ago. According to the Bible, Aaron became the first Jewish priest some 3,300 years ago, and the designation was passed down from fathers to sons since then. Today, many people with surnames like Cohen and Khan believe themselves to be descendants of those priests, known as Kohanim. In the 1990s, Michael Hammer, a geneticist at the University of Arizona, set out to search for evidence of the Kohanim by studying the Y chromosome, which fathers pass down to sons. Because the X and Y chromosomes do not cross over like other chromosomes, the Y behaves like a male version of mitochondrial DNA, staying nearly identical from one generation to the next. Hammer and his colleagues tested the story of the Kohanim by getting cheek swabs from 188 Jewish men, 68 of whom had been told by their parents that they belonged to the priestly line. The scientists extracted DNA from their cells and examined mutation-rich regions in the Y chromosomes. Hammer and his colleagues found a single mutation in significantly higher numbers among the self-identified Kohanim than in other Jewish men. The Kohanim, they concluded, inherited their Y chromosome from a common male ancestor. In later years, Hammer and his colleagues examined Y chromosomes from more men, both Jews and Gentiles. A lot of the Jewish men turned out, once more, to share a close common male ancestor. But others had different mutations that pointed back to other men in the past. In 2009, when Hammer and his colleagues published their new research, they proposed that the priestly line started out just as the ancient stories said. But once the Kohanim tradition emerged, other Jewish men, with different Y chromosomes, somehow became priests as well. At first, reading DNA was such an expensive undertaking that only experts such as Gill and Hammer could do it, and only for scientific research. But the cost dropped so quickly that it became economical for Hammer and others to launch companies that could provide genetic genealogy on demand. People simply spat into a tube that they mailed to the companies, which extracted the DNA inside and compared it to the growing databases of genetic variations in humans. The companies started off looking at a few regions of mitochondrial DNA and the Y chromosome, reporting back about where on earth a customer's combination of mutations was most common. In later years, they cast a wider net, scanning genetic markers across all the chromosomes. Taken together, the markers made up less than a thousandth of the entire human genome, but they varied so much from person to person that they could reveal clues about people's ancestry or even link them, like the Romanovs, to their relatives. Some customers took the tests in the hope of finding cousins or connecting themselves back to famous ancestors. Others hoped to reach back across the oceans to places where they came from. Europeans searched for their Viking ancestors. African Americans could leap beyond slavery's void. In 2016, a remake of Roots aired on the History Channel. LeVar Burton, who had played Kunta Kinte in the original version, now served as an executive producer. To promote the new version of Roots, Burton took a DNA test from 23andMe, along with Malachi Kirby, the actor playing Kinte in the remake. "I've always felt there was a piece of me missing," Burton said in a video. As he studied his results on an iPad, he looked deeply moved. "Who I am did not just begin here," Burton said. "To have the proof in my hands is just powerful." I had heard much the same thing from other people, both friends who got themselves tested and people who have read some of the articles I've written about genetics. One reader told me how she had spent years using historical records to trace her ancestry to Jamaica and Ghana. She then told me that a genetic test showed she descended from two peoples in particular, the Akan and Guan. "In my family, I am tall and my siblings and parents are short," she told me. "It was when I received DNA and folk history that showed a blending of Akan and Guan ancestors that I understood the appearance of tall and short in our family." I wondered what I might find in my own DNA. Was I carrying a molecular version of history of the Goodspeed family? Would a Zimmer version hold more surprises? I wondered what collection of genetic variants I had inherited from those ancestors, how they had influenced my fate. I thought back to the visit Grace and I had had with a genetics counselor when we had floundered our way through a family history. At the time, the first human genome project was still underway at a cost of $3 billion. 15 years later, my friends were giving ancestry tests as birthday presents. In the 15 years since my last visit with a genetics counselor, the gene BRCA1 had become a medical celebrity. Certain mutations to the gene drastically raise the odds that a woman will develop breast and ovarian cancer. Those mutations are especially common in Ashkenazi people. I knew of at least one woman on my father's side of the family who had had breast cancer. A friend of mine who had a BRCA1 mutation was dying of breast cancer at age 48. Had my daughters inherited that fate from me? If I found out, how would I tell them? These questions were humming in my head when an email turned up in my inbox. A geneticist named Robert Green invited me to a meeting. "This should be an extraordinary and very select learning experience if you can make it," he promised me. The meeting would be on the future of genomes in medicine. Green and other scientists would give talks about how they were using genomes in their research today and how they might use them in the future. People coming to the meeting could opt to pay to have their genomes sequenced. For $2,700, a gene sequencing company called Illumina would determine all 3.2 billion base pairs in a person's DNA. Clinical geneticists would then look at the variants people had, searching for mutations linked to 1,200 diseases, some familiar, such as lung cancer, and others obscure, such as cherubism. Don't be fooled. Cherubism doesn't make you look like an angel. It fills your jaw with cysts. I signed up. I was attracted not by the prospect of a medical report. I wanted to get my hands on the raw data itself and find some scientists to help me explore it. Before Green's invitation, I could only guess about my DNA from the stories my relatives told. Now I'd be able to read my genetic heredity down to the letter. Chapter 7. Individual Z. Robert Green and I stood inches apart. His eyes scanned across my face from ear to ear, from forehead to chin. "What I'm doing," he murmured, "is looking for any facial features that would suggest an underlying genetic illness." He looked me over as if I were a horse he was thinking about buying. "The shape of your eyes, whether your ears are low set or not," he said. "The complexity of your ears." Getting my genome was turning out to be a lot more complicated than I had expected. I could not simply spit into a tube and mail it off to a company like 23andMe. In 2007, 23andMe began providing reports on DNA directly to consumers. For $999, they would identify the variants at 500,000 sites in a person's genome, analyze them for clues to their ancestry, and even supply a report about how the variants influenced risks for disorders ranging from diabetes to Alzheimer's disease. Their service was a profound leap from conventional genetic tests. They had to be approved by the FDA and ordered by doctors. Now 23andMe was delivering information straight to customers. In 2013, the FDA told 23andMe to stop selling unvalidated tests or face the consequences. In response, the company cut back their reports to Ancestry and nothing more. Other companies, such as Illumina, took notice. To get my genome from them, I would have to get a doctor to order it for me as a medical test. Green, who had originally invited me to get my genome sequenced, also agreed to sign for the test. First, however, he would put me through a thorough, old-fashioned genetic exam, the kind that Lionel Penrose might have given in the 1950s. "Future clinicians may judge this to be unnecessarily cautious," Green told me, "but there is no standard for how we do whole genome sequencing, so this is how I've decided to do it." I had taken the train to Boston and made my way to Brigham and Women's Hospital for the exam. I first sat down with a genetic counselor named Sheila Suti, who took out a form entitled Family History. She began asking about my relatives. As we spoke, she filled the page with circles and squares, slashing some of them with a diagonal of death. She noted allergies and surgeries. Question marks recorded the many times I shrugged my shoulders in ignorance. Suti drew a network of symptoms and uncertainty. When I looked at the form, I could not see any signal of heredity. Green arrived just as Suti was finishing up. A looming, silent medical student trailed him. Green peered at my face through his narrow, frameless glasses. He was taking advantage of the fact that genes play many different roles in our bodies. A hereditary disease that causes hidden damage to the nervous system may also disrupt the development of the face, leaving behind clues that a geneticist can spot with a naked eye. Green then asked me to walk back and forth from wall to wall. He crossed the arms of his white lab coat as he looked down at my feet, sizing up my gait. Green told me that these conventional exams didn't reveal any signs that required a test for a specific disease. He signed the request for my genome, and Suti led me to another wing of the hospital, where a phlebotomist slid a needle into my arm. I watched blood glide like scarlet motor oil out of my arm and into three tubes. The tubes were shipped across the country to San Diego, where Illumina's technicians cracked open my white blood cells and pulled out my DNA. They blasted the molecules with ultrasound, shattering them into fragments, and then made many copies of each one. Adding chemicals to the fragments, they were able to determine their sequence. Now they had to assemble these fragments together like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Just as a puzzle solver can use the picture on the box lid as a guide, the Illumina team consulted a reference human genome to figure out where each of my fragments had come from. Some fragments were too enigmatic to locate, but overall, Illumina was able to rebuild over 90% of my genome. From one person to the next, human genomes are mostly identical. But in a genome stretching over 3 billion base pairs, the tiny fraction of DNA that varies adds up to millions of differences. Most of these variations are harmless, but some can give rise to a disorder such as PKU. Others raise the risk of more common conditions like cancer or depression. Illumina's clinical geneticists searched my own collection of variants for any especially worrying ones. A few weeks after my visit to Brigham and Women's, Suti called me with the results. The reason we're doing this over the phone and not in person is that we didn't find anything of clinical importance, she said. You had a very benign report, Carl. Suti told me that I didn't have any dominant mutations known to cause diseases with just a single copy. Nor had I inherited two copies of a dangerous recessive mutation. I did find out a few useful things about my health, though. The sequencing revealed variants that could affect the way I respond to certain medicines. If I ever get hepatitis, I know I shouldn't get treated with a combination of interferon and ribavirin. And like all humans, I'm also a carrier. That is, I carry single copies of recessive variants. If my children inherited the same variants from both me and Grace, they might develop genetic diseases. In the early 2000s, when Grace and I became parents, DNA sequencing technology was far too crude for me to get a full catalog of my carrier variants. The best we could hope for was to have our daughters tested for a few diseases, such as PKU. It turned out I'm a carrier for two genetic disorders I never heard of, one called mannose-binding lectin protein deficiency, the other familial Mediterranean fever. I had to do a little research to understand this particular inheritance. I learned that mannose-binding lectin protein deficiency weakens the immune system, leaving babies to develop disorders such as diarrhea and meningitis. Familial Mediterranean fever, the result of mutations to a gene called MEFV, causes people to suffer from painful bouts of inflammation in their abdomen, lungs, and joints. I don't know which of my parents I inherited those mutations from, but I'd bet that I got my faulty MEFV gene from my father. It is most common among people of Armenian, Arab, Turkish, or Jewish descent. It's far rarer in other ethnic groups, like the Irish, from whom Grace descends. It would be extraordinarily unlikely that she would have a faulty MEFV gene, too. At worst, my daughters are carriers, like me. And that was all. After more than a century of advances in genetics, I got a glimpse at my genome, something that had been impossible until recently, and there wasn't much for Suti and me to talk about. A week after our phone call, I took the train to Boston to attend the Understand Your Genome meeting. At lunch, an Illumina representative logged me into a secure web page that elegantly displayed my results. I could compare my own genome to the reference genome, displayed as two rows of colored letters. Where my DNA differed, the colors were brightly mismatched. Along with disease-related variants, Illumina revealed a few more associated with physical traits. They meant little to me. Your odds of developing male pattern baldness are increased if you are Caucasian, Illumina told me. You could call me Caucasian, but I have a thick thatch of hair. Your muscle fibers are built for power, the website lied. The whole experience was charming, but dull. I certainly didn't want the excitement that comes from discovering you have cherubism, but getting to see my own genome shouldn't have been boring. I was pretty sure that if I could dig deeper, or rather, if I could enlist the help of some scientists to dig deeper, I'd be able to learn much more about heredity. After a few weeks of wrangling and paperwork, I managed to get all the raw data from Illumina. It showed up at my door one January afternoon in a white cardboard box. Inside was a shroud of green bubble wrap, inside of which was a kidney-shaped black pouch, inside of which was a slim-brushed metal hard drive. It contained 70 gigabytes of data, the equivalent of more than 400 high-definition movies. To make sense of that data, I took my genome on the road. On one trip, I drove down I-95 to the Yale campus and walked up Science Hill to reach the office of Mark Gerstein. Gerstein's office was heaped with scientific bric-a-brac, Galileo thermometers, Klein bottle coffee mugs, blinking lights that feed off the electric current in your skin. Gerstein's conversation was packed as well, pinging so quickly between genomes and cloud computing and open-access scientific publishing that I sometimes had to look back at my notebook to remember the question I had just asked him. The idea of telling me about my own genome intrigued Gerstein to no end. Over the course of his career, he has analyzed thousands of genomes. He helped lead a study called the 1,000 Genomes Project, for starters. But he'd almost never looked straight in the face of the person from whom one of those genomes came. As I handed him the drive so that he could copy my genome to his computer, he confessed to a vicarious thrill. "I'd never have the courage to do this. I'm just too timid," he said, laughing. "I'm a worrier. Every time there would be a new finding, I'd look in my genome to see if I had it." While Gerstein and his team got to work, I went to the New York Genome Center, where a group of scientists were building a genealogical database they called DNA.land. They created a website where anyone could upload their genetic data for scientific research. In exchange, they would analyze people's DNA and share whatever genealogical clues they could find. My brother Ben had gotten his DNA sequenced by a company called Ancestry.com. Not his whole genome, of course, but 682,549 genetic markers. I asked him to upload his file to DNA.land in order to compare our genes. Thanks to meiosis, Ben and I are not genetically identical. Our genomes are made up of different selections from our parents' chromosomes. Yet, despite our differences, we still have many long stretches of identical DNA in common. DNA.land could confidently recognize 112 identical segments, each one stretching 100 million bases or more. While we are far from clones, there's no one on Earth who's more genetically similar to me than my brother. If I were to compare myself to one of my first cousins, I'd find fewer identical segments. We share a pair of grandparents, but they also inherited some DNA from their two other grandparents. The segments we share are also smaller, because there have been two generations between us and our grandparents for meiosis to chop our inherited chromosomes into more pieces. DNA.land found 45 other people among its 46,675 volunteers who had enough stretches of identical DNA to suggest they might be my cousins. It was also possible they were not closely related at all, our identical DNA a persistent legacy of ancestors who lived centuries ago. I looked at the names of these possible kin and recognized none of their names. Ben was inspired to do some digging and discovered that one of them, a possible fourth cousin named Elias Gottesman, had a harrowing story. As a child, he had been sent to Auschwitz with his family, and there the camp's doctor, Josef Mengele, did experiments on him and his twin brother, Jeno. Mengele was especially taken with twins because he believed he could discover the genetic roots of diseases by examining them, sometimes even dissecting them alive. By the end of the war, Gottesman lost his entire family and even lost his name. Only decades later, as an old man in Israel, did he begin searching for them again. A genetic match to cousins in the United States revealed his birth name. His cousins even sent him a picture of his lost parents. The DNA Gottesman and I inherited from an ancestor might mean we were close kin, but I didn't contact him or any of the other possible matches that DNA.land sent me. A genetic connection did not join our lives together. In fact, if I were to compare my genome to those of my fourth cousins, I'd find that I don't even share any DNA with some of them. That may sound impossible, but only because in modern Western culture we've made the mistake of equating DNA with kinship. That's not actually how heredity works. The more distantly a cousin is related to you, the more generations back you have to go to find your common ancestors. It also means that over those generations, the DNA from those ancestors got cut into ever smaller pieces and was mixed with the DNA from ancestors you and your cousin do not share. It's purely a matter of chance which copy of a DNA segment ends up in an egg or a sperm. And so, in time, one ancestor's genes may disappear altogether. In 2014, Graham Koop, a geneticist at the University of California, Davis, determined that if you brought together 100 pairs of third cousins, one of those pairs would share no identical segments of DNA at all. If you brought together 100 pairs of fourth cousins, 25 would lack this genetic connection. The same holds true for our ancestors. If I were to compare my genome to those of my grandparents, I'd be able to find large chunks of identical DNA from all four of them, each totaling roughly 25% of my genome. In the next generation back, I have 8 great-grandparents, contributing more chunks, but smaller ones. With every generation back, my number of ancestors doubles. Roger Goodspeed is among 1,024 ancestors of mine 10 generations back. But according to Koop's estimates, I inherited only 628 chunks of DNA from that entire generation. There's only so much room in my genome, and so a lot of their DNA did not finish the journey from my 10th generation ancestry to me. For any particular ancestor from Roger Goodspeed's generation, there's a 46% chance I didn't inherit any of their DNA. I grew up imagining Roger Goodspeed as some kind of American Adam to my family, bestowing Goodspeed genes on all his descendants. But it's pretty much a coin toss whether I have any of his DNA at all. And even if I did, Koop's calculations show I'd be able to trace only about 0.3% of my DNA to him. As you move further back in genealogical time, an even bigger paradox looms into view. We think of genealogy as a simple forking tree, our two parents, the product of 4 grandparents, who are descended from 8 great-grandparents, and so on. But such a tree eventually explodes into impossibility. By the time you get back to the time of, say, Charlemagne, you have to draw over 1 trillion forks. In other words, your ancestors from that generation alone far outnumber all the humans who ever lived. The only way out of that paradox is to join some of those forks back together. In other words, your ancestors must have all been related to each other, either closely or distantly. The geometry of this heredity has long fascinated mathematicians, and in 1999, a Yale mathematician named Joseph Chang created the first statistical model of it. He found that it has an astonishing property. If you go back far enough in the history of a human population, you reach a point in time when all the individuals who have any descendants among living people are ancestors of all living people. To appreciate how weird this is, think again about Charlemagne. We know for a fact that Charlemagne has some living descendants, thanks to the genealogies proudly drawn by the Order of the Crown. But that fact, according to Chang's model, means that every European alive today is a descendant of Charlemagne. The order is hardly an exclusive club. When Chang developed his model in 1999, geneticists couldn't compare it to reality. They didn't know enough about the human genome to even guess. By 2013, they had gained the technology they needed. Koop and his colleague, Peter Ralph, a statistician at the University of Southern California, set out to estimate how living Europeans are related to people who lived on the continent hundreds or thousands of years ago. They looked at a database of genetic variants collected across Europe from 2,257 living people. They were able to match identical stretches of DNA in different people's genomes, which they inherited from a common ancestor. Ralph and Koop identified 1.9 million chunks shared by at least 2 of the 2,257 people. Some of the chunks were long, meaning they came from recent common ancestors. Others were short, coming from deeper in the past. By analyzing the chunks, Koop and Ralph confirmed Chang's study, but they also enriched it. They found, for example, that people in Turkey and England shared many fairly big chunks of DNA that they must have inherited from a common ancestor who lived less than 1,000 years ago. It was statistically impossible for a single ancestor to have provided them all with all those chunks. Instead, living Europeans must have gotten them from many ancestors. In fact, the only way to account for all the shared chunks Koop and Ralph found was with Chang's model. Everyone alive 1,000 years ago who has any descendants today is an ancestor of every living person of European descent. Even further back in time, Chang and his colleagues have found, the bigger the ancestral circle becomes. Everyone who was alive 5,000 years ago who has any living descendants is an ancestor of everyone alive today. The Order of the Crown may be big, but an early pharaoh of Egypt might be able to get a club 7 billion strong. I asked the scientists at the New York Genome Center to look beyond my cousins and use my genome to tell me something about my ancestry. They started with the simplest pieces of DNA to interpret, the mitochondrial DNA I inherited from my mother and the Y chromosome I inherited from my father. By 2015, geneticists had built massive databases of both types of DNA, with sequences of hundreds of thousands of people. They organized the sequences in much the same way a taxonomist might classify insects, dividing them into classes, dividing those classes into orders, and so on. Large groups of men across the world have certain Y chromosome mutations in common, known as haplogroups. I belong to haplogroup E, I learned. Its ranks are made up mainly of African men, but they also include some men from Europe and the Near East. Within that haplogroup, I belong to a smaller one known as E1, and within that, E1B, and so on, all the way down to the haplogroup E1B1B1C1. That particular haplogroup includes some Jewish men. While that certainly jived with my experiences with my father's side of the family, the snug fit began wiggling loose when I looked into the haplogroup further. Only a few percent of Jewish men carry E1B1B1C1. Many men who are not Jewish carry it as well. It's found across a range stretching from Portugal to the Horn of Africa to Armenia. When Napoleon died, one of his followers tucked a few hairs from his beard in a reliquary. In 2011, French researchers managed to extract some of his Y chromosome from them. They found that he belonged to the E1B1B1C1 haplogroup too. The highest percentage of men with E1B1B1C1 yet found don't live in Israel. They live in the Jordanian city of Amman. The second highest percentage can be found among the Amhara, an ethnic group that lives in the highlands of Ethiopia. The high percentage of men in Jordan with E1B1B1C1 suggests that it first emerged somewhere in the Near East, perhaps as long ago as 10,000 years, long before the Jewish people existed. Thousands of years later, Arabs, Jews, and other peoples of the Near East spread into Africa and Europe, spreading the haplogroup with them. On its own, my E1B1B1C1 haplogroup cannot let me trace its path back through that ancestry, although I'm pretty sure Napoleon isn't my great-great-great-great-grandfather. All I can know is that there was probably an ordinary Near Eastern farmer some 10,000 years ago who acquired a harmless mutation in his Y chromosome that distinguished a new haplogroup, one that he unknowingly passed down to his son. But even among my male ancestors, that farmer holds no special place. He just happened to be the one from whom I inherited my Y chromosome. On my mother's side, I discovered that I have a mitochondrial haplotype called H1AG1. It's found throughout much of Western Europe and has been found there for quite a while. When a genome sequencing center was built in Hingston, England, the construction workers dug up across a 2,300-year-old skeleton. It turned out to have some bits of DNA in its bones. The Hingston skeleton carried H1AG1, just like me. As for the original Ms. H1AG1, however, I can't say that she lived in Hingston. I can't even say she lived in England. People carrying the H1AG1 haplotype can be found today across Northern Europe. I know I am their kin along the maternal line, but I can't know where our common ancestor lived. Scientists have drawn a tree of all of humanity's known mitochondrial DNA, and on it, my H1AG1 branch sprouts next to other branches common in Europe. The European branches split off from branches common in Asia and the New World. The deepest branches on the tree are found in living Africans. By tracing the mutations along all the branches, scientists can estimate the age of the woman who carried the mitochondrial DNA that gave rise to all haplogroups today. That woman lived in Africa about 157,000 years ago. The first clues that living humans get their mitochondria from a single woman in Africa first emerged in 1987, thanks to research in the lab of Alan Wilson, a geneticist at the University of California at Berkeley. Reporters swiftly nicknamed this unknown woman Mitochondrial Eve. The name stuck like superglue. Newsweek ran a cover story about the research, illustrating their cover with a brown-skinned Adam and Eve. It would take years for scientists to trace back the Y chromosome of all living men. According to the latest research, he lived in Africa 190,000 years ago, at the dawn of our entire species. Soon enough, that man was christened Y chromosome Adam. He now enjoys a Wikipedia page of his own. It's easy to imagine mitochondrial Eve and Y-chromosome Adam as the parents of all humanity, dropped down into a Pleistocene Garden of Eden. The fact that Eve didn't show up in the garden until 30,000 years after Adam died is one of those minor scientific details that cannot undermine a seductive metaphor. It took a couple of weeks for Mark Gerstein to work over my genome. He and his students wanted to analyze the short fragments of DNA with their own software and create their own map. Once they had pinned down the location of the vast majority of Illumina's fragments, they could then determine which variants I carried, and they could try to figure out what those variants meant to me. When I paid my second visit to Gerstein, I was surprised that he wasn't leading me back to his office. Instead, he led me to a conference room down the hall. 8 of Gerstein's graduate students and postdoctoral researchers were waiting for us, flanking 2 sides of a long table, all with laptops and wireless keyboards at the ready. They had me sit down at the head of the table so that they could show me slides on a giant monitor on the wall in front of me. The first slide was labeled Individual Z Overview. It was only then that I realized why so many of the scientists I contacted for my little project were proving to be so strangely helpful. To them, I am Individual Z. It was as if I was a frog that had hopped into an anatomy class with my own dissecting scalpel, asking the students to take a look inside. For the next 2 hours, Gerstein's team picked over my genome, showing me broken genes and duplicated genes and genes with mutations that altered how my proteins worked. But what struck me most of all was what they found when they compared my genome to 2 other people's. A pair of anonymous volunteers who agreed years beforehand to have their DNA sequenced and made publicly available. One of them was from Nigeria, and the other from China. Gerstein's team identified a total of 3,559,137 bases in my genome that were different from the human reference genome. These variants are known as single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs for short. They include the variants that make me a carrier for things like familial Mediterranean fever, as well as ones that influence traits that have nothing to do with disease, like my skin color, and ones that have no effect on my biology at all. The Nigerian and the Chinese had a similar number of single nucleotide polymorphisms, but those variants did not distinguish the 3 of us in any clear way. Sushant Kumar, a postdoctoral researcher in Gerstein's lab, made me a Venn diagram to drive the point home. All 3 of us have 1.4 million single nucleotide polymorphisms in common. There were another 530,000 that I shared only with a Chinese person but not with a Nigerian. And there were 440,000 single nucleotide polymorphisms that I shared with a Nigerian alone. All told, 83% of my variants were present in at least one of their genomes. We were 3 people of African, Asian, and European descent from 3 corners of the world. 3 races, some might say. And yet we shared far more than what set us apart. The concept of race is not like the moon or hydrogen. It is not a feature of the natural world beyond our social experience. Up until the Middle Ages, writers never used the word race in the sense that it would later take on, referring to a sharply defined biological group of people whose members were bound together by heredity. Ancient writers certainly recognized differences among peoples from different parts of the world, but they didn't explain them with taxonomy. The word race seems to have first taken on a modern complexion during the Habsburg rule of Spain. The country was filled with people of different ancestries, Christian Celts, Romans, Jews, Africans. When the persecution of the Jews began, other Spanish people began to think of themselves as belonging to a particular group, old Christians. To prove they were old Christians, noble Spanish families had to demonstrate that they had no Jewish ancestry. In other words, that they didn't have a single drop of Jewish blood. Noble families struggled to prove their ancestry had been pure since time immemorial. When Spain established an empire in the New World, it now had another group of people to distinguish itself from. The Spanish conquistadors, the conquered Indians, and the imported African slaves now shared the same countries. The governments came up with a legal hierarchy with the Spanish on top, Africans in the middle, and Indians at the bottom. But the people of the New World would not respect those boundaries. Through marriage or rape, people from different races had children together. The colonial governments needed to invent new categories with new names. In Mexico, the viceroy sliced his subjects into fine distinctions. 1. Spaniard and Indian beget mestizo. 2. Mestizo and Spanish woman beget castizo. 3. Castizo woman and Spaniard beget Spaniard. 4. Spanish woman and Negro beget mulatto. 5. Spaniard and mulatto woman beget Morisco. 6. Morisco woman and Spaniard beget albino. 7. Spaniard and albino woman beget tono atrás.